Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So welcome to The Media Project for another week. We have to hope to have an opportunity to bring you some commentary, analysis, and maybe even a little insight into the media issues recently. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston.
Hello, welcome back.
Sir, thank you. Swell to be here. And Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, columnist, commentator, gadfly about town.
Hello.
he's not just a gadfly about town. He's a gadfly about seven states.
About seven states, yeah. Right?
That's sweet of you, Ira.
I meant it in the nicest possible way.
That's sweet of you, Ira. What do you have in store for me today?
Hey. Gadfly doesn't have to be a negative term.
No, I don't think so at all.
It often is.
It occasionally is.
Yeah, but the world needs people who are getting burr under the saddle, so to speak.
Yes.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's very nice of you.
Well, I think you're a pain in the... where were we? Devices are the thing. You know, there is a huge increase, and we've talked about this in this show, in the use of mobile devices as opposed to laptops or desktop computers. This is a big deal. The latest now being smartwatches. And, you know, we've seen it in science fiction for a long time.
Shades of Dick Tracy.
Dick Tracy! Two-way wrist radio. But now these things, these fully functioning Android devices or whatever with these little micro cards inside them, are actually a way that people are going to be getting information. And the last data I saw suggests that the number of smart device users who are accessing news on their devices tripled over the span of just 2 years. So this is clearly how it's going.
So, Rexy, what's new? I mean, I've been reading the New York Times all night long, you know, for years now on my iPhone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get up, they change the stories. The paper the next day is seldom what it was overnight.
Yeah.
As you read the stories. And it really does show that paper has its limitations.
Paper has its limitations. The most significant, when Chris Christie went to Florida some days ago, right after the bridge controversy, he went down to do some fundraisers, closed fundraisers. You know, the press is not there. A friend of mine was hired as a stringer for the Times to cover these events in Palm Beach. And
tough service
to hang out outside a fundraiser in Palm Beach. But what was cool was I read that last paragraph of the Christie story on my iPhone in the morning. It was not in the print edition because, of course, the deadline was earlier. So you're actually getting a better product if you get the digital
stuff. No question. So you went down to Houston and you had this, as you do, you're regarded as a guy who goes to the major conferences, the pointers, have you speak and other places. And what did you learn?
We had a meeting of Hearst editors and publishers and other newspaper executives in Houston where our company owns the paper. And my conclusion was, we don't really know what's happening.
Yeah, I think it's very scary for us in the media business, and I don't just mean the print side of the media business, but at the same time, it is very exciting that the technology is changing so quickly that those of us who have to make business decisions and establish some sort of a business model based on technology, A, aren't really sure if we're going in the right direction, and B, it's likely that the direction is going to change not all that far down the road because the technology continues to change.
I mean, give us an example of that.
I'm seeing stories this week that are suggesting that Facebook is not going to be anywhere near as important or vibrant in the next couple of years that it is now. Now, as we sit here right now, that's...
But more Twitter, right?
I don't know that people are saying that. I mean, I've read stories, particularly because of the level of discourse in Twitter, that says that that might be not the source sooner than later. I mean, as Rex says, we sit around, the executives sit around at meetings, editors sit around at meetings, and we sort of tentatively take a step forward and say, all right, we're going to go this way now.
So we'll have a paywall, or we won't have a paywall.
Oh, but that's a whole other
part of it. That's a great example, actually, though, because, I mean, here are companies like Iris Company now has brought down paywalls around their content. You never would have done that. A year ago, I think your executives were saying, we wouldn't do that, right?
Yeah, they're not calling it paywall. I guess we could call a spade, but we're calling it all access, and we're tying it into the cost of the print edition, and if you buy the print edition, you get all access.
Right.
But if you don't, there is a meter now on our website.
In other words, how many stories you can have.
How many stories. Now, that's not new. The New York Times has been doing it for a long time with apparently some level of success.
The Gannett papers are doing it now, Poughkeepsie and Westchester and so on. Mm-hmm. Those papers now have paywalls. And you can understand, I mean, the rationale being people ought to pay for the content that they're accessing, right?
So don't we have a little hiatus here in between, a little space between the monetizing of the web and paying for the paper? So what I mean by that is sooner or later, it's clear from our conversation here, and we told you so, folks, that it's all going to be web and that that's where everybody's going. And yet, the newspapers can't make the same money from the web as they made from the paper. But eventually, they will, because that's where everybody will be going. Or am I wrong?
I think they can, I think that we're going to have to find more revenue from unconventional sources. For example, a lot of smaller publications have made money for years on meetings and events. The Business Review, for example, is a weekly in the Capital Region, one of a national chain that does this kind of thing a lot. And certainly they make a good share of their revenue off events. They charge $40 or something for people to come to a breakfast, and they get a couple hundred people. And those are issue-oriented events where their journalists can raise questions, talk about things. It generates stories and contacts. So I think there's a model for that. We are going to be doing white papers that we'll be producing from our newsroom, where our reporters will create high-impact content, and we can sell those separately. It will be stuff that they've written stories about. But you remember, it used to be there was a thing called the Kiplinger Washington Letter.
Sure.
This is my favorite example. Sure. They would send out this 4-page printed thing every week to businessmen. I worked for a publisher who used to get it. And it was really, I think, the received wisdom from reading the Washington Post closely.
Sure.
Mostly.
Right.
But you're sending it out, and people thought they were getting this inside information. Well, you know, we in the media actually have access to a lot of information that we just can't use. We can't fit it into the paper. So maybe that's the kind of thing we can
do
more.
I don't know. The real question is, who will pay for it? We know that in Albany and New York City, a new institution called Capital has now been raised. And first you got it for free. That's how they get you, you know, and everybody took a look at it in the morning. But frankly, Rex, I'll be honest with you and probably get my head chopped off for this. It wasn't significantly different than the blogs that you guys do at the excellent blog that you do at the Times Union. It wasn't. I mean, how much can you say? What, Andrew Cuomo has a public schedule today? You know,
say that again.
Who cares?
Well,
so unless they can get the kind of staff that will do investigative reporting, which is what they say they're going to do, but you know, the Cuomo people play it pretty close to the line.
It's hard. Now, they're going to begin charging $6,000 a year for access to their panoply.
Yeah, I just got a letter asking me whether we wanted to spend $6,000. What?
You'll get a little newsletter in the morning for free, but you can for $6,000 a year. Now, they have more reporters reporters than we do in the Capitol. They have a big team of reporters.
Sure, they stole all of yours by paying them more money. But the question is, those people who jump ship, if the experiment doesn't work, where are they going to be?
Well, that's exactly the question that is raised over the past week by some defections. The key blogger, the smart young man at the Washington Post, Ezra Klein, and two of his associates are going off on their own to form their own venture. The difficulty is that they're you might call them franchise players in covering Capitol Hill, but they were looking for $10 million to fund their enterprise. And Jeff Bezos, the new owner of the Washington Post, apparently thought that there wasn't really enough revenue in this to warrant that. So they're going off on their own. And
well,
I don't
know
how that works.
I don't know what the difference, Rex, is between Albany and Washington. I do think I have somewhat idea about that. I once wrote an article for Empire State Magazine in which I asked people who left the legislature to run for Congress, and a guy who is no longer there started out his remarks by saying you leave Albany for the same reason somebody leaves Class C ball to go to the majors.
Oh, really?
Well, he was
lovely.
They drew his district out of existence.
So I guess he washed out of the majors. But, you know, it is really interesting. You see people leaving the New York Times. I mean, that used to be, one journalist was saying, that was the journalistic equivalent of being a federal judge. You're there for life.
That's right. My nephew has just been hired as an editor in the digital side of the New York Times, and I congratulated him and said I'm glad that Fussfeld has finally made it to the New York Times, which is because that was always my goal when I was a kid. And now to think that journalists are going to the New York Times, achieving some notoriety there and then leaving is another indication of how this media world is upside down.
It's like the sports guys. They get an agent, and the agent says, I can get you more money somewhere else, and there's part of that. Or, just let me complete the analogy, although the first one may have been a little weak, it's like the stars on my favorite television show, Law & Order, and they drop out. And they drop out because everybody watches them every night and they're convinced they're worth something. But then in many of those cases, not Sam Waterston, but others, you never hear from them again.
Huh. You're right. There are a number of TV actors who made their bones on TV and thought they could get into the movies and then flopped in the movies and should have never left TV where there's plenty of money to be had. I just think, to sort of wrap up the whole thing about the paywall and the mobile, is we in the print press still have so far to go, because even as we established paywalls and start generating some revenue that we were not getting, it's still relatively small peanuts. We need that money, but it's still not enough to pay for the quality of journalism and the amount of journalism, which is much more. You need so much more content to keep your mobile sites fresh all of the time. An operation like mine, and to a little bit similar extent Rex's, which is larger, have to have people staffed at hours where we didn't used to have people staffed because we could go home after the press ran. So there is this chase right now where we are dribbling in some revenue on the digital side. Even with all of the cuts that we've made on the print side, we're still not meeting that. We're not meeting that line, and it's difficult.
In search of the big peanuts. Then, as you say, we're not small peanuts. There we go.
No. Yeah, and you're dribbling
in. Technical term.
And that's what happens.
So if you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith here. That'd be the professor, the publisher, and the editor. If you'd like to join the conversation, send us email, media@wamc.org. Did I say that right? Wamc.org.
Hey, Rexy, did you see that Glenn Beck. You know, who was really...
Who?
Yeah, right. You know, he got into trouble. He lost his show on Fox. He decided maybe he was one of those guys who thought he could do better by setting up his own thing. We don't really know the full story. But now he's issued, like Lee Atwater of old, an apologia, saying, I was too divisive. I tore people apart in this country. And looking back on it, I did wrong.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, there's a guy who left a major franchise. He left Fox News to start his own company, and we haven't seen as much from him, heard as much from him.
We're not sure that he left.
Yeah,
he was asked to leave because even by Fox's standards, he really did a couple of things that were over the edge, and the negative publicity from that may have even been too much for Fox.
So have we forgiven him is my question. Me? No, I haven't. I really feel that the damage he did in this country was incalculable. And I'm glad he's saying that he sees the error of his ways. But one wonders if he was still on Fox whether he would have seen the error of his ways the same way he did once he was a relative nobody. And now gets, of course, all of the publicity for having changed his line.
There's an awful lot, I think, still of divisive content that goes on.
Sure.
These guys who are really entertainers, Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, who turn public policy issues into spectacle, really, by the language they use, and they incite people. You know, in journalism, one of the tenets that we follow in our brand of journalism is to use only the language appropriate to the content and not to inflame people. Like, you don't say, in fact, I was even taught as a young journalist that you don't say the ambulance rushed so-and-so to the hospital, because ambulances always drive as fast as they can. I mean, so you're actually over-dramatizing by doing that. Yet you see this kind of inflammatory language now being the coin of the realm in Fox News, frankly, in their news applications.
But I take a little bit different view, and it's this. In the newspaper business, long before there was an internet and before there was cable news and the polarized versions of cable news, we had op-ed pages and we had opinion pages in which we had hopefully strong and well thought out opinions. And there were liberals and there were conservatives. And much of the language was pretty hot, trying to get some action and to raise some bubbles and make you want to read them the next day. But when you read that piece in the newspaper, you digested it or not and put down the newspaper and you went off on your way. With the talk radio and now cable news, it's constant. The drumbeat is, and each program feels it has to do its own version. So thus, you know, each host on Fox has to do a Benghazi piece. Each host on MSNBC has to do a Bridgegate piece, a Christie piece. And it's on and on and on, and it wears you out. And it's individually not all that much different than the kind of commentary we may have in the newspaper in the morning. But it's the newspaper, I don't know what Marshall McLuhan, how he would describe it, but you read it and you put it down and you digest it. It's not in your ear all day long, as opposed to what is going on cable and on talk radio. And by the way, it's funny, because at the end of the day, we all, including the three of us, talk about Fox and we talk about MSNBC, and we've sort of fallen into it ourselves. Their total viewership is not all that large. It's larger than, I guess, any one single newspaper in the country cumulatively. But at the end of the day, it's not a number that would move the Nielsen ratings if it was right, compared to broadcast. So I don't know whether we should just say, all right, so what? It's just a small...
That's what I say, so what? Yeah, I don't watch Fox, and I don't watch MSNBC, except for that scandalous Morning Joe in the morning, who I've seen recently tapping his chest about his Republicanism. You know, there was a while that the MSNBC had muted the guy, and he was kind of quiet about it. Everybody knew he had been a congressman, he had been a Republican, but now he's saying, as we Republicans say, and we Republicans, and I'll tell you, that's a very interesting transition for him. You know, I'm a little concerned about it. Of course, MSNBC, no, but they weren't fooling anybody. They put him on so that they could count.
But he's got a 2-hour or 3-hour block in the morning, and on his program he has a number of other voices, and then he's gone for the rest of the day. If he was to write a column for the New York Times each day, he would write his columns, give his piece, and then we would be done with him for the rest of the day.
I'm not sure I understand your point.
He's just a small piece of the puzzle. He's another voice. I think his voice is valid. I don't agree with it often. To MSNBC's credit, they put him on their air, unlike Fox, which really doesn't
have
a camera.
Yeah, but what are their motives? Fox has a couple of patsies that they put on, who are so-called liberals, yeah. Juan Williams and some of the others. And they make them patsies, all right, yeah.
Well, from there to sports, you know, Ira began his career as a sports writer, so he's going to...
He did.
We are going to talk a little bit about sports, but it's really about a broader topic. There is a website that's an offshoot of ESPN called Grantland. Remember the great sports writer Grantland Rice?
Of course.
So I think it's somewhat of homage to him that they call this site Grantland. And it's sort of a digital magazine, really. They had a piece written by a young reporter named Caleb Hammond that talked about this great putter. Remember what that putter was called? Anyway, it's an exotic putter that some pros picked up.
A putter is a golf club which you use to do putts.
To do it, that's correct, of course. The fact is, it was fraudulent. It was supposedly scientifically designed and by this person named S.A.N. Vanderbilt. And Dr. S.A.N. Vanderbilt had created this putter.
Did they know it was a fraud?
His story exposed the history of this being fraudulent. I believe that there had been some reports that the science was just hoop-de-doo, that it wasn't real. But they went through the whole chapter and verse interviewed Dr. S.A.N. Vanderbilt, and in the course of the investigation, uncovered the fact that S.A.N. Vanderbilt, in fact, was transgender. S.A.N. Vanderbilt had formerly identified as a man. This had not been publicly revealed. S.A.N. Vanderbilt was going to be exposed by Grantland, and she killed herself, which was revealed at the end of the story. And it not only, therefore, identified this person, Dr. Vanderbilt, as a fraud, but also as transgender, and it really led to quite the controversy. Initially, Grantland stood beside the piece. Initially, the piece got a lot of referrals on social media, but it really then has now backfired, and people have apologized. I think it is just worth making note of this. Yes, exactly. That the notion of outing people who do not wish to have such outing is reprehensible, I think. It's really an inexcusable bit of behavior by the media.
But you know, Rexy, it's interesting that you raise that, because this outing thing has been used for years in all kinds of ways. I mean, there have been major public figures, for example, who announce that they are gay or have been for years because somebody else has come up to them and says, listen, you're a traitor to the cause. If you don't do this, we're going to out you.
Right.
And if you don't announce it yourself, we're going to do it for you. And that's reprehensible also along the same line, at least I think it is, along the same lines that you've been describing. But I guess there will always be fanatics.
Well, and it's worth repeating that this person committed suicide before the piece appeared.
Yes.
And so she did not
necessarily. But did she know it was coming?
I don't know the answer to that. I guess he must have told her that he was going to reveal it. So the question is, and this is obviously not just a sports issue, you're saying that it had no place in the story.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can say, well, this is an investigative reporter who came across this in the course of looking into the fraud surrounding this person's invention, and therefore it's just more of the fraud. And I think, you know, you could, I suppose, say that there's a little exemption in the no outing rule if there's a politician who has been virulently anti-gay, who in fact turns out to be gay. If they're working against a group they're a part of, I mean, I think that there is something of a journalistic exemption for that kind of duplicity. But even in that circumstance, I think it's a little unusual. We see less of it now as there seems to be less...
More acceptance.
More acceptance, right. There is less negativity.
But Rex, you know, that's fascinating. One only wonders whether or not the media, whoever they are and wherever they are, when they're doing a profile piece on somebody, let's say a really big New Yorker piece, usually they're wonderful pieces. I'm not saying the New Yorker does this, but I'm saying a part of the puzzle when you're trying to tell people who you're dealing with may be the fact that they're gay, and that that may in fact be relevant to understanding the conflicts that they have.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just don't think it's a black and white issue. I don't know who this writer is. I don't know how ethical he is, generally speaking, but it looks to me like at least something that you'd have to wrestle with and make a very difficult decision, particularly when you're doing a profile piece and you feel you have the obligation to tell as much information as you know about a person. You know, in hindsight, it's clear that nobody wants to see somebody commit suicide as a result of this, but I don't know that it's an easy decision to make. I don't think it is one.
Well, it depends also on your perspective, Ira. I hate to be cruel to you, but, you know, sometimes newspapers can think of any rationale they can in order to do what they want.
And it's very easily second-guessed.
Yes, yes, indeed. Finally today, we take a moment to pay note that KSDK television in St. Louis was reporting on a high school lockdown. Turns out it was a high school lockdown that they caused, and it raises a question about journalistic practices.
Sure.
This TV station news was trying to look into security in the schools, and their reporter went in, apparently tried to walk on into a school, and the school reported there was a stranger walking in the school. They locked down the school. Parents were panicked, and KSDK reported about this, but didn't really, until pressured by competition, own up to its role in causing this lockdown, terrifying people. And I think the point is there are different ways to get at a story. Just because you can do something like that, Well,
I think we had that here in Albany at one point. Wasn't there a television reporter who tried to test whether the security at the airport was good enough? I don't know that it caused the same chaos, but every time you do something like that and try to sneak in to make your point, you run the risk of doing just what you said.
The Today Show did this exact same story. It was a fascinating story. They had a hidden camera. They followed the guy in to show how easily he was able to get into school. I don't have any problem with that kind of story. I think where the St. Louis station let people down was not owning up to it sooner, particularly when there was a lockdown, so that they could reassure everybody, no, this was us. That wasn't a real problem here.
Yes.
I mean, we're getting tweets all day from public officials saying there is a drill at such and such a school today. This is only a drill in capital letters.
Yes.
And that's what we should have had here.
Exactly. Okay, we've reached the end of another Media Project broadcast.
Should be an hour.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next week.
Maybe not this week.
She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments. She stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspaper men meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's uncle. Ting-a-ling-a-ling.